This is the Happy Rant Sports Podcast, in which Ted Cluck and Barnabas Piper rant about old sports, new sports books, sports movies, and anything else related to sports that they feel like. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Sports Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined, as always, in studio by my good friend and fellow sports fan, Barnabas Piper. And Pipe, it is Saturday afternoon, about 3 o'clock. We have just watched Ohio State shellack Michigan. And I think we're both feeling a little down about it, not because we care so much about Michigan football. I know you don't, and I really don't either. But I think just the lack of a good game. And if I have any expectations at all as a fan, it's just that I want to be thrilled by something. I want to be delighted. Like, I want to see something new or something interesting. And I'll tell you, man,
like, even if it's an ugly game, like a game that keeps my attention until the end, yeah, you're like, all right, well, somebody's got to win.
Somebody's got to win it. Somebody's got to do something. But man, those games have been few and far between this season, Pipe. And I don't know. I think, did you watch the, this is a little digression already, but did you watch the Rams Chiefs Monday Night Football game?
I didn't get a chance to, but by all accounts, it was just that kind of game. And also, I mean, just, what was it, 54-51 final?
Yeah,
score?
I mean, it was the ushering in of
absolute track show.
Yeah, it was the ushering in of Big 12 football in the NFL, and yeah, in that, but it was bittersweet.
I mean, it was, but like, didn't the Rams have two or three of their touchdowns set up by great defensive
they
plays?
Did,
those
man.
Like
there
strip
was
sacks
still,
and forced fumbles, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there was still good defense played in the game at times, so it wasn't like fully a Big 12 game. But yeah, like I feel like the sort of viewing experience that I'm looking for as a fan is a little bit few and far between this year. But, you know, the great thing about sports is that there's always more games, you know, there's always more games coming up to watch. And hopefully one of those games will deliver it. Now you're not a big college football fan, are you, Pipe?
I'm not, you know, we're getting to the time in the year when I pay a little bit more attention just cause yeah, you know, they'll pick the teams for the playoffs, it's conference championships, et cetera. But I just like, you know, it's basically, college football is preparation for pro football. So I yeah, just want to know who's going to be in the NFL draft in a few months.
Dude, exactly. And maybe what quarterbacks are going to be in the NFL draft in a few months. Not to hit too close to home on that, Pipe. But I can't help but notice that the Vikings have already lost more games with their new quarterback than they did with their supposedly mediocre quarterback last year. And, you know, it, full disclosure, there's a little bit of satisfaction in that for me, but
a little bit of smugness
in
your voice.
Smugness.
I can hear
like
it.
I really hate to be a smug guy, but sometimes.
So here's the thing. Yeah. I think I predicted that the Vikings were going to win fewer games this year.
You
just because last
totally
year was an ultimate sort of catch lightning in a bottle. Yeah. Everyone stayed healthy, etc. And it's the way they've lost the games that has been really frustrating because just like dumb turnovers and in the occasional play call that you're just like that didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Things were
yeah,
going so well. And then you tried a new thing instead of doing the things that were working.
Yeah.
You know, I hate it when coaches outsmart themselves.
Dude, right.
So
yeah.
I haven't been real thrilled with sort of the consistency and I don't know. They've just been sort of like a B-minus football team in terms of execution, and that's irritating.
Yeah, no, it totally is. And I have to, again, be honest in saying that because of the sort of emotional situation that I'm not at liberty to talk about on the program, I haven't watched hardly any Vikings games this season. So I've just caught highlights and recaps. And yeah, it seems to me that you guys have a Ferrari in the backfield that you're not using at all. And I don't know if that's a function of like just abysmal run blocking or you go too quickly away from Dalvin Cook, but it's been curious to me. Just,
well, he had a hamstring injury for, you know, he played like 1.5 games and then he basically was more or less shelved for about four or five games.
During which point Latavius Murray filled in. He did Latavius Murray things. Yeah, I mean he will always get you what's blocked and not much more, but you know, he's an adequate guy.
He's an overpaid second running back who's also a high quality second running back.
Yep.
But yeah, their offensive line is the to use a brutal cliche, the Achilles heel of the team.
Yeah.
And it and everybody knew it going into the year.
Yeah.
And they haven't drafted. I'm trying to remember the last first round offensive lineman they drafted.
Dude, probably.
I think it was Matt.
Yeah, Khalil. I was going to say, don't you have a Khalil on your offensive line and not the good one?
No, Al,
yeah.
he's playing with his brother in Carolina now.
Okay.
But I mean, that's like 8 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a while.
So you should draft a top three round offensive lineman probably every year.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
In the NFL. And you should probably draft one in the first round every other year.
Dude, speaking of offensive line play, have you seen like the clips that are going viral of Quentin Nelson just killing people as an offensive guard for
yeah,
the Colts?
While screaming like a banshee.
Yeah.
I love
Dude,
it.
Dude, I love it that just, guy it, so
I,
much.
I giggled like a little tiny schoolgirl the first time I saw that.
Same.
Because he was just so mean and he was screaming and you look at that and you go, that's the epitome of an offensive lineman.
That's right.
That is everything you want in an offensive lineman right there.
Exactly, man. Exactly. Football is the best because of stuff like that, man. But Piper, I want to get back to Achilles' heels and I want to talk about a movie that I thought Rocky V excluded was the Achilles' heel of the Rocky franchise, and that's Creed II. So I saw Creed II on opening weekend. I saw it with my son and with my nephew. Expectations were sky high, sort of like the Vikings fan base for this season. So really high expectations for Creed II, and I thought it was a bad movie. And it's funny, like there's no, our culture has no gear for anything in the middle of it was awesome or it was total garbage. And I didn't think it was total garbage, but it was definitely far from awesome. I just think it was a bad movie. And, you know, it's funny, the cultural conversation that we're in seems to preclude anyone from saying that anything that Michael B. Jordan does is bad. We're not really in the headspace where we're saying that just yet. But and he was amazing in the movie. Like, I thought he was great. I thought Tessa Thompson was great. I just thought Creed II was a bad movie. And I know you saw it last night, so I want your thoughts on it.
I'm in absolute and utter agreement with you in terms of their respective performances,
yeah.
But also like the movie just being just disappointing. It felt like a dot-to-dot emotional experience.
Yes, I totally
where it's like,
agree.
Cue the music to tell you exactly how you should feel. Cue the one-liner that is supposed to motivate you. I mean, it was like motivational Mad Libs throughout the movie.
Dude, it totally was.
Especially with Sylvester Stallone.
Ugh.
You know, he's not a good actor.
Dude, no,
he
isn't.
Which means that he has to be inserted into a movie very judiciously to work. And in Creed, it was like pitch perfect.
It was fantastic. Creed Stallone was unbelievable. And that was and we've talked about this. That was like the wheelhouse that he needed to stay in. So let's talk about Stallone for a minute. I thought Stallone regressed from like the awesome old manness that he had embraced in Creed. And he went back to looking kind of tan and waxen and like a very old man who was trying really hard to look less old. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, he looked like former bodybuilder instead of like washed up heavyweight who now runs a small Italian restaurant for kicks.
And also who's 70, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
you could see the Botox in this.
Oh,
one.
Totally. Yeah, you could see the little ripples of Botox like right below his skin. Now, I agree with you on the like paint by number emotional thing where like none of the emotion was earned. Whereas I feel like in Creed, like every emotional response that you had, like they really earned it. But in Creed 2, every Stallone line I thought in Creed 2 had like a fortune cookie wisdom lifetime movie quality about it, in which it all felt inauthentic and forced. And it was almost like everything that came out of his mouth was like this pithy, like motivational thing.
Yeah, it was so bad. And the scenes where that was the worst were when you needed it to be the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was the scenes where like the emotion is hanging in the balance. You know, you've got spoiler alert, Creed deciding whether or not he wants Rocky to coach him or train him for this fight. And that scene was just, it was just flat.
Yeah.
It was basically like a temper tantrum by one guy and the other guy being like, all right, I'll miss you. And,
exactly.
And that was it. And then the scenes when, again, spoiler alert, Rocky manages the next fight.
Yeah.
And he's in his corner, and he's just like, this comes down to who wants it more.
Oh, dude, yeah.
I'm like, what? I mean, what? This isn't junior high.
Right.
That's the line for, like, that's like the overweight middle-aged dad coaching 12-year-olds trying to get them to try harder.
Exactly. That's bad coaching is what that is. Like,
it was, yeah, and, yeah, also, that doesn't work when you're fighting a behemoth who kills people. So,
yeah.
It's not about who wants it more. It's about can you not die?
Yeah, exactly. Dude, so let's talk about the behemoths who kill people in this movie. So I thought Ivan Drago, who is the villain from Rocky IV, if you're familiar with the Rocky franchise, I thought Drago was actually the most sympathetic and interesting character in the whole movie, which removed and ruined a fundamental element from the success of any Rocky movie, which is that you have to hate the opponent. Drago was totally sympathetic. Because his wife, Brigitte Nielsen, left him high and dry after he lost to Rocky in 1985, on the night that Rocky ended the Cold War. So apparently Brigitte Nielsen left Drago and his son high and dry, such that, like, you ended up feeling really sorry for them in Creed 2. Did you have this experience? Like,
yeah.
Did you feel, like, things for them that you probably shouldn't have been feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it was either him or Victor.
Yeah.
Like, to me, Victor Drago, so the son, was the most sympathetic because, like, Ivan Drago had his moment of glory
right. And
lost it completely unjustified because he lost a fight.
Right,
you know,
right. That
should be, that's an aspect of any athlete's career.
Right.
But because it was also, like, the fall of the USSR, they blamed him more or less.
Exactly.
His son lost a mom, lost a home. And then his dad continues to pile that crap on him throughout the entire movie until, like, the last few scenes when it's like he realizes he's about to lose his son too.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he becomes a father. And, you know, there's that sort of just glimpse at the end when they're running together.
Yeah.
Which is a really different thing. But again, it was sort of ham-handed how they did it.
It was. Yeah, for sure.
But, so speaking of Ivan and Victor Drago, did you catch in the first fight?
Mm-hmm.
Max Kellerman, who, by the way, should never be allowed anywhere near a movie. He was the most annoying
character
in the entire
thing. Dude, thank you for saying that, man. My wife hates Max Kellerman, and I'm not sure why, but she just has this long-standing beef with Max Kellerman because of all the boxing I used to watch, like, years ago when I was doing boxing writing, and she just didn't like him. She thought he was smug and arrogant, but in the film, Kellerman acted as sort of like the chorus. Like, if this was a Shakespeare play, Kellerman
right.
would be the chorus in that he's providing all this, like, ham-fisted exposition. It was terrible. It was just terrible.
When it just, I mean, just to be very trite, his voice makes me want to stab my ears with a pencil.
Yeah.
It's just the worst voice. but in the very first fight, he got the name wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed that,
He said, Ivan Drago. You know, he's like, Ivan Drago out here throwing haymakers. And I was like, that was 30 years ago.
Dude, right. And I'm like, is that just like an editing gaffe in the movie, or did they leave that in there for some kind of intentional reason?
I think it was an edit. I think they just made a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, they just missed it, which the whole movie felt like an editing gaffe to me because the performances by the non-Rocky leads were really strong.
Yeah, I agree.
So the Dragos, the Creeds,
yep.
strong.
Yep.
Rocky, not strong, but I don't put that on him because we all know exactly who Sylvester Stallone is.
Yeah.
And so that's a screenwriting and directorial thing.
Yeah.
And this one didn't have Ryan Coogler involved in it.
Yeah.
Well, I think he was an executive producer, but I think he was heavily involved in Black Panther when this movie was being made. So, or being shot. And so it just didn't have any sort of, there was no soft touch
right.
at any point.
Right, no subtlety.
And it suffered from it, let's say.
No, it definitely did. Yeah, the script was a mess, man. The whole thing was like 20 minutes too long. You know what it felt like? It felt like a Clippers game in the early 2000s when, like, they had all those great players, but they always got eliminated from the playoffs with like a month left to go in the season. And, you know, it's like they still have to go out and play the games.
You're like, man, Quentin Richardson hit 6 threes while wearing the awesome headband, and Darius Miles was everywhere and still just not that
good. And they still lost by 12, and, like, nobody's heart was in it. And that's what this felt like. This felt like a movie that you had to make, but, like, nobody really believed in it. Like, I envisioned Michael B. Jordan getting 2/3 of the way through, like, shooting Creed 2 and going, yeah, this is going to be hot garbage. You know, like, I think he knew in his heart of hearts that he had made a bad movie. So this begs the question. I want to run this by you, because I want to compare it to what happened in our theater. So our theater was pretty full, and at the end of the movie, you know, the last fight happened, the credits came up, and there were a couple of beats where everybody just sat there, and then somebody started clapping tepidly, and then a few other people clapped tepidly, because I think the cultural expectation is that you clap at the end of a Rocky movie. Even that, nobody's heart was in it. You know, again, it was like the 2001 Clippers in terms of the clapping.
Right.
And it was just a funny moment where it's like everybody in the theater wanted to feel a certain way about the movie, but we were just trying to kind of convince each other that we felt that way. Did anything happen in your theater after the movie?
Not after, although in the last fight scene, there was a few like audible cheers,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the last fight, I will say they shot the fight scenes pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, sports, they've gotten good at shooting sports movies.
They have.
And also, to actors' credits, they have gotten a lot better at sort of fully investing in being an athlete.
Right.
You know, so Michael B. Jordan, for example, did an excessive amount of training,
yeah,
both physically and as a boxer, to be able to pull it off.
Oh, dude, he looked
which
incredible.
Which makes a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
And but so there was some audible cheers, you know, with, you know, that when he almost doesn't make it up on the 10 count and the knockdowns and et cetera. But yeah, no clapping afterwards. It got done and it was just sort of like, you know, the drone of like, all right, well, time to go home. It's 9:45.
Exactly.
And it was just, that was it. It was very flat.
Yeah. Very, very flat for sure. So do you think this is the end of the franchise? And if so, are you okay with that?
To answer the second half of the question first, I don't have nearly the emotional investment in the Rocky franchise that some people do.
Yeah.
You know, seen them, but I think you almost have to be part of a community of people who are invested in Rocky, or like half people you share this with, where it's a bonding experience,
yeah,
for that to be deeply rooted.
Yeah.
And I think I've watched all but one of them by myself. So,
oh, wow.
Well, I mean,
that's fascinating.
Not the Creed movies, but like, they were just like, oh, I'll watch it on Netflix or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, and also I wasn't really watching them when they were being released.
Dude, see, I think
it was kind of way after.
I think you had the unfortunate like chronology of Rocky really started to suck kind of right as you were entering into like movie watching age. So, you know, by the time you were old enough to watch movies, especially growing up in the Piper household, like Rocky's 1 through 5 had already been made.
So like 30.
Yeah, 30. So like 4 years ago. Yeah. But most of the Rockies, you know, all the good ones had already been made. Rocky 5 was garbage. But yeah, when those movies were popping like in real time, I was seeing them in real time. And then Rocky 4 became like the VHS tape that you popped in whenever you had like a sleepover with dudes, like in middle school. You know, there were a couple of go-to movies. That was one of them. So I probably viewed Rocky 4 like 50 times in my childhood.
I'll also say when I watched the first Rocky, I think I didn't watch it till I was in college.
Yeah.
So what, early 2000s?
Yeah.
Which is way after it came out.
Yep.
I didn't know what I was watching.
Yeah.
I thought it was a boxing movie because I was familiar with the Rocky franchise at that point, and it had become sort of a heavyweight boxing franchise.
Yeah.
Rocky, like the first Rocky is not a boxing
movie.
It's
not, man. The first Rocky is so good, by the way.
It's a care. Well, it is, unless you're expecting to watch a boxing movie.
Yeah, that's true. There's only like 10 minutes of boxing in it, you know?
and I was like, there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of weird characters. It's very dark. It's slow.
Dude, it has the old movie pacing. Yeah, it has old-timey movie pacing where it's really slow.
And so I hated it.
Yeah.
Which I hated it in the way that an ignorant movie viewer hates, which is
sure.
I hated it for what it wasn't.
Yeah. Yep.
Instead of appreciating it for what it was.
Yep. No, I get that, man. I get that. And I've been there a lot. But yeah, really, I mean, the first Rocky, phenomenal film. They probably got progressively worse after that. And even Rocky IV, for being such a cultural, you know, kind of object, it was hot garbage. I mean, it's a really bad movie. Like, if you watch Rocky IV, it's all of like 92 minutes long, and like 70 minutes of that is montage. It's really, really bad, but it's a fun movie to watch
that's kind of what Creed 2 felt like.
Yeah. Yeah.
It felt like it was like one liner, slow motion.
Yeah.
Montage.
Yeah.
you know, and the music they used was not, I mean, no, there was nothing subtle about this movie.
Yeah.
Nothing remotely subtle. It was very, very in your face. I doubt this is the end.
Yeah.
Because if they can rope like Coogler back in, although I don't really know where they go from here unless.
Yeah. Like who does he fight?
Unless there's like a, is there like a Creed 3 where the, their child grows up to be like Layla Ali or something like that?
Yeah, we're going to have to wait like 15 years for that kid to grow up and become a fighter. But Rocky will still be looking waxen and tan and like an ex-bodybuilder at age, you know, 104. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think I'm okay with this being the end of it. I really am. And, you know, as someone who like grew up with the Rocky franchise and who really rides with those movies, like I imagine... Like, I hate Star Wars movies. Like, I'm just not interested. But the people who are really passionate about it, like, I'm that passionate about the Rocky movies. And I'm okay with this being the last one. Like, I would rather see them be done than make another bad one like this. Because it's a matter of expectations. You know, it's like being a passionate fan of a team and then going out and seeing that team suck. You know, you feel let down. You feel, you know, like you wasted your time or your money or whatever. So I'd rather see him like just shut it down. This isn't like an embarrassing one to end on. Like it wasn't just a disaster. It was just not good. And,
well,
you know.
Especially when paired with the first Creed, which was a really good movie.
So
I mean,
good.
They did after what was it? Was Rocky V called Rocky V or was it called Rocky Balboa?
Dude, so Rocky V was called Rocky V and Rocky VI was called Rocky Balboa, which is actually low-key good. But I think that one being low key good was even a matter of expectations in that I expected absolutely nothing from that movie. Like I had zero expectations for Rocky Balboa because of how bad Rocky V was. And it was actually pretty okay. Like it was kind of cool. But
it was kind of a nothing movie in terms of cultural significance.
It was very much a nothing movie.
Like, we're just going to make something that's a money grab.
Dude, right. It didn't come out at Christmas. It wasn't like this big hyped up thing. It just kind of happened, you know? Yeah.
So they did successfully breathe life into the franchise with a fresh storyline, fresh face, good performances. This wasn't a great movie to end with, but like you said at the beginning, like there's, We only have two options, and one is it changed my life, and the other is it deserves to be flushed down the toilet.
Yeah.
And it falls firmly in, like, it's lukewarm leftovers.
Dude, right,
it's just kind of eh.
Right. And, man, I just think culturally we need to refine that gear. You know, we need to be okay with something being, like, neither life-changing nor miserable. You know, it can be somewhere in between, and I wonder if it's a...
Considering that's most of life, actually.
Dude, right. And this kind of dovetails nicely, I think, with the book that you're writing, vis-a-vis expectations and vis-a-vis just how we talk about things, because, you know, social media, I think, has created this environment where, like, you know, if the meal isn't amazing, we're not photographing it, we're not talking about it. So, like, if it goes on social media, it's just, like, this transcendent experience, or we want people to think that it was. Whereas, yeah, most of the time, you know, the game that you've bought a ticket to or the movie that you've decided to, like, go and watch on Thanksgiving, it's not transcendent. You know, it's just 2 hours, you know.
I've watched hundreds of professional sports games in my life live and then, you know, hundreds and hundreds more on TV, and almost none of them are memorable.
Dude, right. Yeah.
But that doesn't have anything to do with enjoying the experience.
Dude, it's funny, know? Man. I'm so glad you mentioned that because as I look back on like all the games that I've watched in my life, almost none of them are memorable. But the ones that are memorable because of some sort of outside thing that happened. Like I remember one time, I used to go to one Colts game every year with my dad. My pops would shell out for like one pair of Colts tickets every year. Sometimes it was preseason. Sometimes we'd get lucky and we catch a regular season game. But I remember one time they played the Raiders at the Hoosier Dome, and it was right toward the end of Jerry Rice's career when he was with the Raiders. And we had gone down low to watch warm-ups, and there were these like kind of drunk hillbilly Indiana white dudes who apparently had like been at a bar with Jerry Rice the night before, and Jerry had let them like try on his Super Bowl rings. And it was this great moment between these, like, just quintessential central Indiana drunk dudes, you know, screaming at Jerry, like, hey, like basically, hey, do you remember us from last night? Do you remember when we tried your ring on? And of course, Jerry Rice was like 100% dialed in on the game. But it's little little things like that. I remember one time we saw the Colts play the Patriots at the Hoosier Dome. And again, this was like early, late 80s, early 90s when, you know, fan-player interactions were different. But we were down right by that rail watching warm-ups. And one of the Patriots players like turned around and tossed a football up at me and like played catch for a couple of minutes with me in the stands. And I just thought, man, this is the greatest thing in the world, you know? So I couldn't tell you the scores of any of those games, but little experiences with pops and the weird fans and, you know, just all that stuff, I think is what gets kind of cemented.
And that's the thing is like a sports game is not a memorable thing.
Right.
There are like snapshots that are,
yeah,
you know, so
sure.
I remember moments from games, you know, I remember the one foul ball I caught at a Twins game.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember, you know, those kinds of things, you know, the one time we were screaming at somebody from the left field bleachers and got him to turn around and wave at us. That
yeah,
kind of
exactly,
thing.
Man.
But like you said, like I couldn't tell you who was pitching those days.
Right.
I couldn't tell you the score. I can tell you the Twins probably lost because it was at a time when they did that.
Frequently.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
And, but just not a lot. Those experiences are not supposed to be permanently life changing things, nor is Creed 2.
Yeah.
It's just supposed to be really fun for 2 hours, or at least like moderately fun for 2 hours.
Dude, moderately fun, escapist. And I'll tell you, Creed 2 did deliver on that level. Like it was totally something to do. And yeah, if I had squeezed it into an already busy day, or if I felt like full of expectation, I may have been like legitimately pissed that it wasn't good, but yeah, I was not at all pissed. I just felt like, huh, this was not as good as it could have been. And you know, it's funny, like now that I'm a dad, I think I want the games that I take my kids to be more transcendent than I expected them to be as a kid. Because as a dad, you're like, you're shelling out all that money and you pile the kids into the car and you're like, I want them to feel the buzz, like walking into the stadium that I felt when I was a kid, but like, you can't create it, you know, you can't make that thing happen. And I think the best experience I've ever had at a football game with Maxim, my younger son. So we used to live in Michigan. This was right before we moved south. And there was a college football program in Michigan. They're in the MAC, Eastern Michigan. And at the time they had won like 2 games in the previous decade. Like they'd had a bunch of 0-for seasons and they were terrible. Mm-hmm. But they would advertise on the radio a whole bunch and their tickets were like, they were literally giving the tickets away. And there was one Saturday where I woke up and it was like 55 and sunny. And I just threw Maxim in the car and we drove to Eastern Michigan with my dad. And there were like 4 people in the stands and they basically let us in for free. They let us sit on the front row. They gave us like a Jimmy John's sandwich and they seemed just like thrilled that we were there. And so Maxim basically had like the Northern Illinois mascot to himself, and Pops and I could listen close enough to hear like what the coaches were saying to the players on the sidelines. And it was an amazing experience watching this like monumentally crappy team, but which tip of the cap to Eastern Michigan, they've been bowl eligible the last 2 years. So they have turned it around, but yeah, that was one of our best sports experiences and it just kind of fell in our laps.
I think trying to create memories for your kids is, it's much more shotgun method than sniper method.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, in terms of like, you just got to try a bunch of stuff.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
My kids bring up the most random things that were meaningful to them.
Yep.
Or the random part of something,
yep,
you know, that meant nothing to me.
Yeah.
And you know, sports are the same way where you want them to have a transcendent experience and like see a no hitter or see a guy rush for 250 yards, or see a,
yeah,
you know, a field goal to win it with no time on the clock. And in the end, it's like a 24-7 game,
right,
and it's slogged through the mud. And what they remember is, yeah, the one guy who tossed him a football, or
yeah,
the, you know, the coach who high fived him on the way by or whatever.
Yep.
Which is just as valuable.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah, you're right. That's a good word. You know, the shotgun approach more than the sniper approach. I think that, you know, that's a great one for sure. But Piper, speaking of transcendent sporting experiences, our very own Mike Conley Jr. of the Memphis Grizzlies, Recently had what was the record that he broke? It was most assists in a quarter. He had like 10 assists in like 10 minutes of basketball the other night against the Clippers. And this guy is like quietly having one of the best seasons of he is having the best season of his career. He's playing great basketball, and you wanted to talk about him. So what do you want to say about Mike Conley Jr.?
So I was watching the Timberwolves play the Grizzlies a few games ago, and the Grizzlies are, you know, somehow, some way they keep going with a very grit and grind style.
Yeah.
You know, just counter every NBA culture. Yep. They slow it down. They beat people up. Mike Conley is unbelievable.
Yeah, he's really good.
Has he made an All-Star game?
I don't think he has, which is more a function of like, you know, who else is making the All-Star game ahead of him.
You know? I mean, when you play in a conference with Chris Paul and Steph Curry and James Harden and Kevin, you know, whoever else, all the guards, it's very hard. But just watching him play, the thing that he made me think of was like watching Emmett Smith play running back.
Yeah.
Because Emmett Smith was not fast. He wasn't overpowering.
Yep.
I mean, he was a great athlete. But it was the kind of athlete where you have to pay real close attention to see where it shows up in terms of like timing and agility and the way that he uses his brakes instead of his acceleration.
Yep.
And Conley's never moving fast, and he's getting by people, and he's got this ridiculous little floater game, which is, you know, he's a good shooter.
Yeah.
He's a good finisher around the rim, but he just does some weird, unorthodox stuff. And I don't know. I was blown away because it was sort of the first time I'd watched him play in a long time for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
And thought this man is a wizard.
Yeah. No, it's really impressive. And I think if you're a fan of a program like the Grizzlies, like that's what you go to the games for. You know what I mean? You go to the games because you can occasionally see a transcendent performance out of one of your guys. And it helps if you like the guy. And this is especially true in the NBA now, where like really there are only like three or four teams who realistically can even think about like winning the title from year to year. So, you know, there's all these other cities with NBA teams, and you got to have a reason to go watch, right? Like you got to have a guy or two on your team that you enjoy watching, and, you know, you can bring your kids out to watch them. And yeah, like we said, hope to have that transcendent experience where the guy has a, you know, really dials it in and has a great night or whatever. I think for me, like that's more how I watch the NBA. And I know you watch because of the Timberwolves, and you're a fan, but you're a fan of the game as well. And, you know, for me, I really don't have a team per se that I care that much about, but I have individual guys that I like watching.
Conley, I think, so he came to mind, especially because I was trying to think of any other player in the NBA who is less appreciated compared to how good they are.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And
I wonder why.
The only other one who comes to mind is maybe like Paul Millsap, but I think he's sort of on the backside of his career.
Yeah.
And he kind of earned the title of underrated for a while.
Yeah.
You know, where it was he's the most underrated player in the NBA. And once you're the most underrated, well, you're kind of properly rated.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Conley is just, I mean, it's hard to come up with like six or seven point guards who are better than he is.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, so this begs the question, why hasn't one of those like super teams made a run at Conley? You know, like why hasn't he been a guy that, you know, that's been sort of that in demand, I guess. He's just been kind of mired in this Memphis situation where the team is perennially around 500 and not interesting. And you know, he's just kind of stuck there. You know what I mean?
I think it's for a couple of reasons. One is it's sort of a heyday for point guards in the NBA right now and has been for a couple of years where there's only one or two teams that have bad point guards.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, most teams have above average point guards because that sort of breaks the idea of average.
Yeah.
But they have point guards that would have been considered above average 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, just in terms of what's valued in the NBA, three-point shooting and wing play.
Yeah.
And so Memphis's two best players are probably the two most undervalued positions in the NBA, and that's point guard and center.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, they make it work. They're still competitive. I think they were in the top two or three in the West as of, you know, the past week.
Right.
And, but he just, that's the other thing is you look at it and you're like, I mean, if you put him on the Timberwolves instead of Jeff Teague, mm-hmm. They're a playoff team.
Yeah, that's true.
As currently construed, you know,
that's true.
He takes over the Jimmy Butler role of star.
Yeah.
He's a level head. He's a great teammate.
Right.
His young teammates would play better because of him. He makes everybody better.
Yeah.
And he knows exactly how much to kind of impose himself on the game in terms of scoring and forcing the game. You know, if you put him on Denver, same thing.
Yeah.
Because a bunch of young talented guys with no real good point guard play.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing across. Kind of across the NBA, you look at this, you're like, he would make at least 20 out of the 30 teams better right off the bat if you just swap point guards.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think the only reason that doesn't happen is because he's paid a lot of money.
Yeah, that's true, man. And also Memphis has, they've like not fully committed to the tanking rebuild model that a lot of teams have. So I'm afraid Conley is just going to kind of be mired there for a while.
So here's the thing. Tanking is a way to win a title.
Yeah.
And it, like if you're playing the zero sum game of you either win a title or you fail, then tanking makes sense.
Yeah.
If you're in a city like Memphis where you go we don't have the TV money to kind of be flush. We're not going to attract free agents based on anything the market has to offer. So that leaves us the option of tanking and really hoping we get great draft picks or just persistently being competitive.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they've made the right choice. They've kind of done what Indiana has done
where
they never want to fully tank. They want to be around 500 or better every year.
Yeah. And maybe you figure if we can get to the tournament and we stay healthy and the other teams have some injuries, we've got a puncher's chance, you know?
And I think they've just looked at it and been like, it's the breaks of the game to win a championship in some ways, or it's a super team era. Well, we're never going to be a super team. So, but it's not that the only other alternative is win 22 games and try to get a top five pick.
Yeah.
And so they're persistently 40 to 49 wins.
Yep. Yep.
And just slugging away.
Yeah.
And
dude, slugging away,
fans,
drawing decently, you know.
Yeah. But they wouldn't draw decently if they were like, guess what? We're trading away Marc Gasol and Mike Conley for a bunch of first round picks. So Jaren Jackson is going to be the star of our team.
Yeah.
They'd have 4,000 fans there every game for about 3 years.
Dude, you're right. It would be a tough hang. I mean, it'd be a tough slog for a while. Which really begs the question, Piper, and this is fascinating to me. And I don't know the answer to this. And if I was a GM, I don't know that I would know how to handle this. Is it a zero-sum game? Because I think from the fans' perspective and just the narratives that we've grown up with, you know, the narrative is always like a new guy signs with a team, whether it's a coach or a GM or whatever. And the narrative is always, well, I'm here to win a title. And it's like, well, yeah, at some level, of course you are. You know, you're here to win a title. You're here to win every game. But in a very real way, if you're a GM, like you're trying not to get fired. And if continuing to win and put a good product on the floor with regard to the limitations that you have in your market, like if that gets you not fired, then at some level, aren't you doing a good job? You know, like, I don't know. And I guess in the media, you have to say that it's a zero-sum game and you have to say that we're here to win a title. But if you're continuing to win more than you lose and you're not getting fired, I mean, it's kind of the Marvin Lewis model, right? He's been the Bengals head coach for, you know, 150 years and he's gone 7-9 or 9-7 every season.
Yeah. I think his best year was like 11 wins and his worst year has been, you know, 6-ish, 7-ish. But yeah, he's almost always in that two games over to two games under.
If you're a Marvin Lewis apologist, do you say to yourself, like, he took over this moribund franchise, the Bengals were terrible, and he made them relevant? You know, and every year they're pretty relevant. You know, they're always in the wild card conversation. They're not an easy out. You know, Andy Dalton is Andy Dalton. They've got AJ Green, who's a superstar. Like, they're relevant, you know. But at the end of the day, do you go to the mattresses for Marvin Lewis as being a great coach? You know, probably not. Which begs another question that you teased, I think, off the air. Like, is Jim Harbaugh a good coach? Kind of looping back around to the Michigan conversation of he's...
Oh, and in college football, it's absolutely a zero-sum game unless you coach at Iowa.
Dude, right. At a place like Michigan, so, it's a zero-sum game. At a place like Iowa, it's not.
Kirk Ferentz just got a $500,000 bonus for winning 8 games.
Dude, and I honestly think Kirk Ferentz is a great coach. Like, I think he's a great coach because he gets...
Because they win 8 games every single
year. Dude, every single year they win 8 games.
10 or 12.
Yeah, occasionally they have their magical, like, 10 or 12 win season at Iowa. You know, you're not in a recruiting hotbed. You're not in, like, a destination city. You know, it's Iowa. And for that guy to have done what he's done there with the kind of consistency with which he's done it, I think that makes him a great coach. Now, it is a zero-sum game at Michigan. You know, at Michigan, if you haven't, like, competed for a national championship in 4 or 5 years, like, you're done. So it,
to be fair, Michigan hasn't competed for a national championship since, like, Charles Woodson was there.
Dude, that's true.
And I mean, have they even sniffed it since then?
I don't know that they've sniffed it. You know,
how long ago was that? 20 years?
Dude, that was 20 years ago. Yeah. Which, to be fair, like, as an older person, it doesn't feel like that long ago to me, but it really was, you know. That was a long time ago. And I think the sort of DNA of college football has changed in that I think it's a little harder to recruit to Michigan in 2018 than it was in 1998. You know, in that in 1998, you were still close to Bo Schembechler. There was still this, like, ethos of Michigan as this elite program. It was pre... like, streaming games. It was pre, like, there's a game on every day. Like, Michigan was on national TV almost every weekend, and it made them magical in a way that they are not now. You know, same with Nebraska. I mean, Nebraska now is just a huge school in the middle of a cornfield with a huge stadium, and they have trouble recruiting, and they have trouble winning, you know. Whereas in 1988 or even 1995, like, going to Nebraska was a huge deal. That meant that you're playing on ABC every weekend, and, you know, Brent Musburger was calling your games, and it was a huge thing in a way that it's not now. It'll be interesting to me. The Michigan fan base is just vicious, and they were vicious with Harbaugh in the offseason, and they kind of, like, reached detente with him during the season because he was so successful this year, but I think it's going to be brutal for him tomorrow.
Yeah, that's the thing is, I think they – so, you know, you praised Kirk Ferentz for being a consistent winner at Iowa.
Yeah.
I grew up in Minnesota. The difference between the University of Iowa and the University of Minnesota is negligible.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
There's literally no difference.
Right.
And, in fact, Minnesota ought to have an advantage.
Dude, Minnesota's in a way cooler city. You know.
Yeah, because at least it's a sort of a major metro area with some cool culture. Granted, it's – I mean, the weather's not really worse. There's nothing worse about it.
Right, right.
And Minnesota's just a dog of a football team and has been, with the exception of, you know, the Glenn Mason years and, like, one or two Jerry Kill years where they were, like, 8 or 9 win teams.
Yeah.
So Michigan needs to realize that's them.
Yeah.
Like, they still identify themselves. They're like the guy who's 27 years old wearing his high school varsity letter jacket.
Dude, that's
Michigan.
There's a ton
right
of
now.
Truth to that. But that fan base is so and I say this with a great deal of affection because I like Michigan football. Like, the fan base is so arrogant. Like, they still think of themselves as the top of the top, the elite of the elite. And I mean, I think these programs that have been able to take a dip and then kind of reimagine themselves are the ones that are able to adapt and do better. You know, like, look at Miami's not having a great season this year, but, you know, Miami as a program they've had all these peaks and valleys, but they do continue to get back up, you know. And I think hiring the guy that they hired was, you know, a good
Mark was it Mark Richt?
Yeah, hiring Mark Richt was a good hire.
Who is another guy who persistently was really good at Georgia, but since it's a zero sum game, he got fired.
Dude, right.
Because he couldn't, he was like 10-2, won his division in the SEC regularly, couldn't get past Alabama. You know who else can't get past Alabama? The rest of the country.
Yeah, the entire world for sure. Dude, so he,
and I mean, I guess he struggled with beating Urban Meyer when he was at Florida. So, I mean, he couldn't beat the elite of the elite, but persistently really good.
Dude,
teams.
So here's my thing, and I want to get your take on this. Like, if we were football coaches, Piper, and let's say we had just won like the MAC championship, and we just had some magical year at Eastern Michigan, and all these Division I programs came calling. I think the ideal job to have would be one of these non-zero-sum game programs where you go, you make it better, you win consistently, and you become a legend at like an Iowa or a Northwestern or a Syracuse. So I'm a Syracuse fan, and we have Dino Babers, who I think is a fantastic coach, really creative, really interesting guy, great motivator. He won 9 games this year, and conventional wisdom would say that Dino Babers is going to ditch us to go to some, you know, Texas A&M type program. You know, some program with like a little bit more prestige and more visibility, like USC, you know. But USC is a zero-sum game program where unless you win 10 games every year and you're...
And in fact, at this point, it might just be a zero program.
Right.
Like, it's just... It's completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
Again, they're living.
It's perception.
They're living on the memory of Matt Leinart. Congratulations,
dude! Exactly. Which that was dang near 15 years ago, Pipe. You know, I mean, it may have been 15 years ago.
Yes, it was. When all of your best players from those college teams are now calling NFL games on television because they've retired.
Right.
That tells you how long ago.
Absolutely, dude. So for me, I think getting one of these zero sum game or non-zero sum game type jobs in a city or a metro area that you like, I think that would be tip top, man. You know, and so a guy like Pat Fitzgerald, who stayed at Northwestern, or Kirk Ferentz, who stayed at Iowa, like tip of the cap to those guys, because at any point they could have bolted for like a bigger, more prestigious job. But I think they got a pretty good thing going, and that's the kind of thing I would want. So the question you ask yourself is, does that make you sort of less uber competitive? Does it make you less of an alpha dog to say, I want to stay at Syracuse and win 8 or 9 games every year and be a legend, rather than like going to, you know, Florida State to try to keep them in the national title discussion every year?
No, I mean, I think it makes you realistic.
Yeah.
Like you have to look around and go, okay, well, yes, there is that level of potential success,
yeah,
along with all the crap that goes with it. Which means you probably get 3 years in a major program, and if you haven't sniffed a championship in 3 years, you're on thin ice. And but then you look around and you go, you know, there are only 100-something major conference college football coaching jobs in the world. And if you get one of those and you have success there, you are one of the elite college coaches. You're one of the elite football coaches in the world. And if it's a place where, like, Pat Fitzgerald at Northwestern is a great example because he's an alum. Didn't he go there?
Yeah, he went there. He was a great linebacker in the early 90s.
He was a great middle linebacker. For some reason, I froze and for a second. But, yeah, so he played middle linebacker there. He was on, like, the Darnell Autry team, like the team that just sort of randomly popped up as a
went to the Rose Bowl
conference champion. And why would he leave?
Right.
If he can win 8-10 games at Northwestern consistently, a school that has significant athletic disadvantages,
right?
He is a legend. He's going to be their winningest coach if he keeps this up. He's going to be in their Hall of Fame. He will be loved by a ton of rich alums and have a post-football career for as long as he wants it. And if he would step back and look at the grand scheme of things, he would say, that was an awesome career. And I wasn't less competitive. I didn't settle for Northwestern.
Right.
I made something fantastic out of my career. I wish more coaches would look at it that way.
Yeah.
You know, like Scott Frost going to Nebraska, he's an alum, so that made sense.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
But like, if he had gone to USC, like, why?
Yeah,
you're winning at Central Florida?
Right. You're living in a pretty nice place, living in Central Florida. You'd be a legend there for the rest of your life. You know,
and at some point, if you keep winning there, you become sort of the Gonzaga of college football,
right,
where Gonzaga went from mid-major Cinderella to, no, they're just one of the best programs in college basketball.
Yeah.
Like, he could have done that at Central Florida. And instead, he's now got to try to do it at Nebraska with all of the, like, the Tom Osborne shadow.
Dude, the Osborne shadow, all the pressure, like, all these fans and alums who still have this, like, misguided vision of the program is this sort of legendary thing that it's not anymore. Yeah, I feel really bad for Harbaugh. Like, I feel like they're going to want to put his head on a stake tomorrow morning, and I'm not sure it's fair. You know, that being said, though, what do you do with a guy like that who has gotten your program close but not quite over the hump? You know, you're not beating the bitter, hated rival that, you know, everyone in your fan base is obsessed with beating every year. Like, Michigan didn't even sniff being in that game today, really. I mean, they got lucky at the end of the first half. A couple of things went their way, but, you know, they weren't even playing the same game today. So what do you do with that? Like, do you fire Jim Harbaugh and start at ground zero again? Or do you, like, go, well, this guy's coaching a Super Bowl, he clearly can do this, do we give him more time? I just don't even know, you know?
Well, that's the thing is, like, you also look at Harbaugh and you go, he had a run of success between, was it University of San Diego,
yep,
Stanford, and then the 49ers, but it was all with a certain brand of football that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Nobody plays that kind of football.
Right.
Not at the NFL level, not at the successful college programs. Like, Alabama doesn't even play that kind of football anymore. And they were the last one to just sort of ground and pound you.
Right.
Because they could.
Well, and dude, there's a scarcity even of kids to play that kind of football. Like, where do you recruit a kid that's been in a 3-point stance? I mean, all these high school kids and junior high kids, they're all playing in spreads ever since Pee Wee. I mean, there are linemen in this country who have never been in a 3-point stance, and you're going to try to teach them a new game, you know?
There's a reason why every year Wisconsin puts their entire starting five offensive line into the NFL, because they're like, he's a large human who knows how to run block.
Yeah, that's
right.
We'll
take him.
Dude, if I was an offensive lineman with any kind of size and pro potential, I would go to Wisconsin, and it wouldn't even be close, you know? Like, if you want to play on Sundays, you have to go to a Wisconsin or an Iowa or one of these programs.
Notre Dame's another one,
yeah,
where they consistently put, like, grunt players into the NFL.
Dude, but there's only a handful of these programs anymore, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, Harbaugh is trying to, you know, you're trying to find guys to do a thing that nobody's doing anymore. And I do think it presents, at some level, a weird opportunity, but yet, you know, the whole thing hinges on linemen. And if you can't shop for linemen, like, if you can't find those guys that you need to do that thing. I mean, it's why Nebraska was so great in the 80s and 90s, because every high school program was running the Veer, you know? And, you know, you could find all kinds of huge behemoths who, you know, could bench press 400 pounds and could run block because everybody was doing the same stuff.
And when you had a 280-pound guard who was slow, that was okay because the defensive tackles were the same. Like, there wasn't guys running 4.5s on the defensive line.
Yeah.
I mean, the game has just shifted. I think Harbaugh needs to end up at a place where expectations are just lower.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where if you win, you're appreciated, but expectations are just lower.
Yeah,
and like, he's, because Michigan, to be the head coach of Michigan, given the expectations, it's like a CEO position.
It really is, man.
At Stanford, he got to just, like, wear his ugly khakis and teach guys how to block and run. And
yeah.
And to be fair, his best years at Stanford, I think, were also Andrew Luck years. So,
well, yeah, and at Stanford, everybody was super pumped if you won 8 games. You know, like, the bar was significantly lower, which is
it's like Northwestern West.
Right. It is a great academic school, you know, super elite in that way, which Michigan is too. But with Michigan, it's just you have the added baggage and burden of, like, all these expectations of what people think the program is. And I would not want to coach at a place like that, man. I think I would want to coach somewhere else. So yeah, with these guys, like, you know, even like Lane Kiffin coming up at Florida Atlantic, it's like, he's going to be successful there. And then he's going to bolt for some, you know, crappy zero sum game kind of job. And he's going to be right back on the same cycle that he was on before. So yeah, it really is a miserable kind of nomadic existence for these guys. Cause if you're Harbaugh, like, let's say you get fired by Michigan, like, where do you go from here? You know, do you do like a couple of years sort of sojourn into the NFL as an assistant? Maybe you go work for your brother. I don't know what that looks like, but I would not want the burden of another one of these elite, you know, quote unquote elite programs. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what would make a ton of sense for him is one of these other, like, big universities that's not a football powerhouse to throw money at him. Yeah. You know, like like Texas Tech, who's probably going to fire Cliff Kingsbury, I would think, because their offense is always great and the team wins five games.
Right.
Or Baylor. You know, one of these schools that has money, they have boosters they can pay.
Right.
But success for them is not measured on championships. It's measured on, can we be a lot better than we've been?
Yeah.
And I think Harbaugh would turn those around in a heartbeat.
Dude, or Louisville, right? You get to come in and follow the, like, Bobby Petrino gong show. Expectations are low. They got a big stadium. They're right in the South. You know, like, there are a lot of reasons why that could be an attractive job for somebody, but yeah, it'll be interesting, man. It's always interesting to see where these guys
Harbaugh should stay 1,000 miles away from the SEC, though.
Yeah, that's true.
That would be just an awful idea.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true. Louisville's in the ACC, but still, like, just the proximity. You know.
No, I was just thinking of other programs that, you know, like Arkansas. You know, would be the kind of program where he could have success. But I'm like, oh wait, if you have any success in the SEC, you get vacuumed, like, just sucked into that conversation of championships instead of being satisfied with 8 to 10 wins.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Piper, I am satisfied with the almost hour of good radio that we've done here on the Happy Rant Sports Program. So always a pleasure, my friend. I enjoy chopping these things up with you conversationally, and I hope the fans enjoy it as well. So we have not done this in a while, and it just occurred to me to do it. If you have not gone to our iTunes page to leave a 5-star review, you should do so post haste. That'll just be the Happy Rant show page. We don't have a dedicated page yet for Happy Rant Sports, but go to the Happy Rant page, leave us a 5-star, leave us some fawning words. We're not interested in anything but a 5-star, just full disclosure. Not interested in constructive feedback at this stage of our lives, but the 5-stars do help. So do go and do that if you feel so moved. And until next time, Piper, what's our sign off? I feel like it should be a late 90s or an early 2000s, like, USC player or Michigan player, in honor of
big fat running back for USC, Lindale White.
Wow, I loved Lindale White, dude. He was my kind of running back for sure. So
yes.
Piper, we have wandered to and fro throughout this program and these topics. And until next time, Lindale White.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Are you concerned about tensions in the Middle East? Do you wonder where we're currently at in the biblical timeline? Are we really in the last days? Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Carl Mueller with the Inside the Epicenter podcast. Every week, my co-host, best-selling author Joel Rosenberg, and I answer those questions and more. You'll hear inside knowledge of our meetings with leaders at the highest levels of government in the U.S., Israel, and the Middle East, equipping you to filter the news with biblically sound insights. Find Inside the Epicenter on your favorite podcast app or go to joshuafund.com to listen and subscribe.